Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KAALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me is tonight's co-host, NBC legal and political analyst Dean Johnson. Tonight we cover a topic that's close to our hearts, animal law.
Good evening, everyone. And full disclosure, Jeff and I are very excited about this show tonight. One of the things that Jeff and I have in common is our love of animals. Both of us have worked pro bono on cases involving animal protection, and neither of us accepts cases in our private practice in which the client is charged with animal abuse. But sharing the world with our furry, feathered, and scaled friends creates a web of legal rights and responsibilities. And there is a growing movement internationally which contends that animals themselves may have legal rights. So tonight, our panel of outstanding guests will help us illuminate the important and growing topic of animal law. Jeffrey?
Our phone number right here, after all, there's much to discuss. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, that's outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our guests are here to educate, but they can't provide legal advice about a particular case. And the opinions expressed here don't necessarily reflect the opinions of their employers, their clients, or KALW. Again, our phone number here is 415-841-4134 or 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, that is a question regarding to animal law, or you're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. Dean?
And our guests tonight are Valerie McCarthy. Valerie is the interim executive director of Pets in Need, an animal shelter and adoption facility based in Redwood City in Palo Alto. Valerie also serves as the research editor for the Animal Law and Public Policy Group at Harvard Law School and has done graduate work at New York University in animal welfare. She has worked on critical animal welfare issues nationally and internationally, from rescuing pit bulls in some of New York's poorest neighborhoods to finding homes for cats in Stockholm. She earned the ASPCA's highest volunteer certification in behavioral training. And most importantly, she is the parent of Stanford and Yale, two rescue cat brothers.
Corey Page is the founding partner of Evans & Page, a public interest law office with a portfolio of cases and clients that displays the spectrum of legal approaches and issues involved in improving the lives of animals. Evans & Page represents the nation's premier animal advocacy organization. Corey has also worked as the independent general counsel for the Peninsula Humane Society since 2018. Mr. Page is an adjunct professor of animal law at Santa Clara University and at the University of San Francisco, and continues to be a guest lecturer at law schools. Corey is a regular speaker at national conferences and has been interviewed by the Los Angeles Times Magazine, National Public Radio, and local and national newspapers. Of course, we have one more guest. Our most important guest is you.
And I'd like to start the conversation tonight with Valerie. I'm very curious. First of all, can you tell our listeners about Pets in Need? And secondly, can you tell us how in the world somebody goes from Harvard Law School to directing an animal shelter?
Well, first off, thank you, Jeff and Dean, so much for inviting me to join you tonight and carving the time to talk about animals and animal law. So at the risk of sounding dogmatic, no pun intended, I firmly believe that animals as sentient beings deserve serious consideration under the law, and really more than they do today, which I know we'll talk about tonight. And as you'll hear me say later, I don't think there's anything much more powerful than the human-animal bond. So both from an animal welfare, animal rights standpoint, and a sociological standpoint about the important relationship between humans and animals. And I'm talking about all animals, whether that be wild animals like minks or elk, liminal animals like pigeons or rats or domestic pets like our cats and dogs. This is a very important topic. So thank you again. So now to your question. So Pets Indeed is an animal shelter based in the peninsula with facilities in Redwood City and Palo Alto. And the organization was founded in 1965, and our mission is to provide animals with loving care and lasting homes, to partner with communities striving to do the same, and to advance our no-kill legacy. And Pets Indeed has a bit of a unique sort of business model, in a sense that we have what we call a hybrid model, meaning that we have both a private facility, which is our Redwood City facility, where we control the intake of animals, as well as a public facility, which is our Palo Alto facility, where through a municipal contract with the city of Palo Alto, we are the animal services provider for the cities of Palo Alto, Los Altos, and Los Altos Hills. And so in Redwood City, under the private model, we partner with other shelters in greater need, and we transport these animals from these underfunded, overcrowded shelters in areas of generally low adoption demand to our Redwood City facility, where we can care for the animals and have more potential adopters. And at our Palo Alto facility, we take in any stray or seized animal that animal control officers bring us. And we also take in owner surrendered animals from these cities. So our Redwood City facility, it's kind of interesting, primarily handles just cats and dogs. But given our municipal services relationship, our Palo Alto facility regularly handles not only cats and dogs, but also rabbits, guinea pigs, chickens, turtles, and wildlife like opossums, foxes, birds, and that the animal control officers find. Last year, just to give you a little bit of a context to the size of the organization, last year we helped over 3,000 animals either find new loving homes or get the needed medical treatment to stay with their current facilities. Fundamental to our mission that I just want to add and work is an unwavering commitment to the power of the human-animal bond. And we believe this human-animal bond is incredibly powerful regardless of race, gender, age, or socioeconomic status. So we commit at Pets Indeed a significant amount of resources to enable this human-animal bond in families who traditionally would not have access to animals or animal care. And we do this by trying to eliminate the barriers to access to animals or animals or animal care. So for example, to those who need it, we provide low cost and free vaccines, medical care, food, and supplies. And we do this both in our shelter and as well as out in the community through mobile units. And another example I think is really important to talk about, and we might want to talk about it more in the show, is how we think about an acceptable adopter. So traditional adoption models create all sorts of barriers in the application process, landlord checks, fence requirements, home checks, et cetera, each of which excludes a segment of our community we want to serve. So instead of projecting onerous requirements on our community, we have open conversations about the animal, his or her behavior needs, et cetera. And then we let the potential adopter make the final decision based upon what they know. And this is what the industry is calling open adoptions, and it empowers the adopter instead of the shelter taking an all-knowing and all-powerful role, and greatly extends the potential for this ever-important human-animal bond.
Let me jump in before going to the phones, which are lit up right now. I do want to give Corey a moment to tell us a little bit about your practice.
Thank you. And appreciate being on the air with you, Valerie and Jeff and Dean. It's a pleasure. Like Valerie, I'm very happy that animal law gets the time right now. It seems to be starting to gather momentum. Let's say we've been working on it for 20 years at our practice, and things are only getting better. We do a wide array of cases. We do animals in entertainment, animals in raised for food, so agricultural situations. We do domestic animal issues, vet malpractice, you name it, instances of injuries between neighbors over animals. Also, as you mentioned in our introduction, and I appreciate that introduction, I am the independent general counsel for the Peninsula Humane Society, shelter and animal control organization. As you know, anyone lives in the peninsula, Peninsula Humane Society not only advocates for animals, but takes care of huge number of animals and also enforces animal control and humane care ordinances and state laws throughout San Mateo County and approximately 20 other cities. So yeah, I got an exciting practice doing animal law with my partner, Geneva Page. And now I'm blessed to be able to work with Peninsula Humane Society.
And Corey, you know, I noticed that you have some current cases going that are really fascinating. Everything ranging from civil rights to slap suits to suits regarding dangerous dogs. Tell us about the couple of the cases you've got going on right now.
All right. So, you know, we're doing a lot of food cases now, too, where, you know, animal issues, you got to follow it all the way through. You're helping animals. Then you're also looking at how animals are ending up in our food supply and how we're consuming animals, because the back end of that is the animals being raised for care to meet that consumption. So we started our practice 20 years ago doing the Sonoma foie gras case. And that was our one of our first cases. I worked on the bill, filed the first case against animal cruelty case against the Sonoma foie gras producers. And cases now that I think are interesting. We have a public records case that I think is really great on behalf of a group called PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And we're trying to get records from the regents of California about the research they're doing with Elon Musk's company, Neuralink, on closest living relatives. And they're putting chips in their brains to monitor how those animals react and how we can possibly control their behavior. But obviously it's a research institution paid for with tax dollars, so the public records law applies. So that's one of the interesting cases. And I'm happy to get right into the callers too, if you want.
Yeah, you know,
that sounds like a great transition.
Our phone lines are lighting up. Let's go to the callers.
Let's go to John from San Francisco. John, welcome to your legal rights.
Yes, I had a question regarding stray animals. So I have a cat that got out of the house, went missing for a little bit. I went out of town. I believe one of the neighbors found the cat, turned it in as a stray. Then the animal shelter contacted me and let me know. Because I was out of town, I was not able to return in time to claim the cat. So I wound up surrendering it. But then the shelter turned around and billed me a couple hundred dollars for I guess room and board. And I'm wondering, I've never heard of something like this before, and being charged for room and board for a stray cat.
So, what about that, guys? What are the rights and obligations of the shelter once you take on an animal?
Valerie, would you like to respond to that, or do you want me to?
Yeah, no, I'll jump in on what our policy is at Pets in Need. So it's a legal requirement that if a stray comes in, we have to hold it for a minimum of 7 days for either us to be able to contact the owner. If there's a chip in the animal, we can do a scan and identify the owner, and there will ideally be updated contact information where we can connect with the owner, like I think has happened in your case on that side. And if we're not able in that, and we also will post it on lost pet boards. And then if after those 7 days we're not able to find the owner, then we do put it up for adoption. We do not charge for room and board at our shelter, so I'm not familiar with that policy.
Corey, didn't your firm just recently do some work on the length of time before an animal can be euthanized?
We did what I would say is a massive case on the Hayden Act.
No relation,
of
course.
It went on for years and years. And eventually the appellate courts agreed with me that in talking about how long a shelter has to hold animals, there used to be a word that was just called how, you know, they have to hold them for a certain number of business days. An undefined phrase, business days. So they, all the shelters in the state, and this actually goes to the caller too, all the shelters in the state define that term differently. And so you had a patchwork of holding periods throughout the state, and my case resulted in the court saying, yeah, that's not appropriate. And so this went back to the state legislature and they clarified the law. But going to the caller's point, and I don't know the answer to his question specifically, and I think Valerie kind of points this out in her answer, that you have a patchwork of organizations in different counties and cities, and they are providing different obligations and rights to animal owners. And I say owners well aware of the fact that most people consider themselves caregivers for our furry friends. But in the law and talking about the obligations, it does kind of consider it owners. So in that regard, I'm talking about the fact that there is such a patchwork that it is hard to answer a question like the caller's, because it's different from Palo Alto to San Mateo to San Francisco. And it's the same thing with dangerous and vicious dog stuff, as we could talk about later, that there's not a uniform one size fits all, that if you're in one county and I'm in the neighboring county, that you and I are necessarily going to have the same rules applied to our dog that bites.
Let's move on to something that might be more uniform. Let's see what Sonia has to ask about. Sonia from Oakland, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Sonia.
We can hear you. You're on the air. Welcome, Sonia.
Great. Hi. I want to know a bit more about guinea pigs' rights. We have some guinea pigs, and it's pretty known fact that they need to live with other guinea pigs, and they can suffer quite a bit if they're alone. And I know there's some countries in Europe, Belgium being one of them, that has made it a law that you cannot adopt or have a single guinea pig. And I'm just wondering if there's anything like that here, or people have, you know, raising awareness around guinea pigs' rights to be with their own kind.
I'm happy to turn it over to Corey, but I can, in our shelter, I'm not, or in our county, in our city, there's not a requirement on group placement of guinea pigs, but it is our preferred policy that at all times a guinea pig will either go out in pairs, or there needs to be a guinea pig at home when they go.
We don't have that here. Okay.
Sorry. That's a good point, though. And it's something that goes to the fact that anyone who's bringing animals into their home really should be aware of the needs of the animal just as much as, you know, the needs of the human for companionship when bringing that animal in.
Yeah, you often see lone guinea pigs in school classrooms, and this seems really cruel to me. Yes, they get to interact with the people, but I don't know what kind of life that is, really.
I think that transcends different species. I know a lot of the adoption groups, I've volunteered with them for years, and I've adopted from them as recently as the two that I have now. And a lot of them with cats, not as much with dogs, are also looking to adopt them out in matched pairs unless they know there's others at home. And when they are meeting with others at home, there's long-established protocols for introducing a new cat to the environment so that they don't meet in the wrong foot.
I think it's especially important for prey animals because they really need that feeling of safety even more than the predators, I think, being cats and dogs.
I agree. I think that's a good point.
I don't take up too much time, but yeah. Thanks for doing this. It's important.
Sonia, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Let me jump on to Ryan in San Francisco. Ryan, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, it's actually Brian.
Brian, I'm sorry, but welcome.
That's fine. I'm actually a commissioner on the Commission for Animal Control and Welfare for the City of San Francisco. And one of the issues that we've been discussing lately has been dog theft. Since the beginning of COVID, we've had people having their dogs stolen by either burglary in their homes, stolen out of vehicles, or strong arm robbery, including the guy that was murdered New Year's Eve while some kids stole his dog. And as it turns out from our research, California is really behind the eight ball in terms of actually having any penalties for stealing dogs compared to even places like Virginia, where you can get many years in prison for it. So we've been just brainstorming on, you know, different ways that we might be able to have either local or proposed even state law changes. And more than anything, I'm just wondering with the people in this forum if anybody has any brainstorming ideas on what might be done.
One of the things that interests me, and Corey, you might want to factor this in your comments, is that it appears that the law still talks of animals, companion animals, as if they're chattel or property. And that makes me wonder if changing that paradigm would have any impact on how people think of it and how the law would treat them if they are found to have committed something like this. But I'll turn this over to Corey and Valerie. What do you think about that?
So what, Brian, what kind of measures were you thinking, just in a broad stroke, would achieve the deterrent effect?
It looks like we lost Brian. Brian, you're welcome to call us back. One of the things that I found in my own practice, I have one of these cases going now, and I don't think that people are thinking of the animal from a perspective of personhood in the way that we do individually. I think most people out there are thinking in terms of the animals as you would taking a clock off somebody's table.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Jeff. And I think sometimes we initiate laws from a perspective of how a normal citizen would respond or react. But the people who are committing the crimes aren't really taking a look at the law and saying, oh, okay, well, this will get me this, you know, charge if I do this. And so I always wonder about the deterrent effect of even working on some of these new legislative efforts that would, for example, address specifically animal theft or anything like that, only because will it achieve a deterrent effect? What will it do that the current legislation won't do? And that's what I was hoping to kind of hear from Brian.
Well, the good news, Corey, is we do have Brian back with us. But one of the things, Brian, we've been talking about are alternatives that we can do. I join with Corey's remarks that people that I represent are not generally thinking about consequences, as they're not generally thinking about getting caught. But is there something we can do that changes the paradigm, the way that people think of our companion animals, so that people think about something differently when it comes to a pet, and more like you would treat taking their child as opposed to taking something off their table, maybe, you know, well, a clock or something else?
Yeah, shouldn't we really acknowledge, pun intended here, the elephant in the room? What we've been talking about is that I think a schizophrenic attitude that we have towards animals. In some ways, we treat them as property. We say that they can be slaughtered for food or for, you know, for profit or whatever. And in other ways, we treat them as if they have rights. So we have an Endangered Species Act. We have criminal statutes against animal abuse and so on. And I guess the question is, which is it? And should we follow what seems to be a growing trend of recognizing that animals as such actually have rights that ought to be respected, maybe not on a par with human rights, but certainly with a greater level of legal respect than we've seen in the past. And I throw that open to you guys and to the callers and anybody else who wants to talk about it.
Let me ask a follow-up to Dean, and I'll so you can work it into your thoughts on the answer to Dean's question. But is it really that the law is schizophrenic, or is it that the law is evolving and perhaps very slowly? What do you guys think about that?
I would say that there is a little bit of, a philosophical conflict between the way we think we need and use animals and us granting, as a blanket policy, granting them rights. For food and agriculture, the way we consume and treat the animals to meet the food demand needs of our nation, and the way Americans are raised to expect a component of their meals to have a certain amount of animal product, it really makes it difficult philosophically and legally to then throw the layer of all animals deserve rights, natural rights, because that's going to come into conflict with a lot of the things we're doing. One of the cases right now before the United States Supreme Court is exactly that. Got taken up in March for resolution this year, and I'm going to be drafting an amicus brief for one of the parties. It is the size of some of the containing of certain animals that California passed, the law we passed here as a ballot measure to say that, you can't do that. You can't keep animals in these certain confinement. And meat industry is very upset with that because obviously larger spaces for animals, lower profit margins. So what I'm saying is, I think just as a whole, when we think about it that way, it doesn't work as easy, but the way it works is like the Great Ape Project, like thinking of animals that we don't eat and animals that we can break off and say, like, look, our closest living species DNA wise, maybe those deserve to have rights that we can recognize, because we don't have that same schizophrenia, as Dean correctly said. But Jeff, I do think we are evolving. Also, the law is just constantly in flux and changing on this issue.
Well, Valerie, we are moving, I think, towards some recognition of animal rights, to coin a phrase, in civil courts, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
We've talked about divorce courts recognizing or deciding custody of animals based on the best interest of the animal, right?
Right, exactly. And I think, Brian, your question is great, because yes, there's different animals that get treated differently and might need to get different rights, but you're honing in on an example where there's a huge diversion between how we think about this particular animal, our dog, who's considered a family member. I mean, a recent Harris poll said that 95% of pet owners, pet guardians, consider their pets as family members. So yet these are valued family members, but if their child was abducted, there would be a very, very different penalty for it than our dog. But it's like, it's just not computing well in our heads, because we think about this animal as a family member. But as Dean referred to, that California, along with a couple of other states, have recently enacted legislation specifying that courts can allocate pet custody based upon the best interest of the animal and not just the value of the animal. So this is really where not simply the ownership of the rights of the humans are involved. And so this is showing a clear evolution of the law. And I fundamentally think that if we're going to get anywhere with animal rights and animal welfare, it's going to start with the animals in our home that are closest to us, as we're seeing with these civil courts, and then expand out from that. And, as we've seen with any other civil rights movement in history, it takes time. It's an evolution of the law. And I think that's what we're starting to see with some of these civil cases. And Corey can speak to this better than I can, but it's exciting to see. It's really exciting to see some of the evolution that's starting to happen.
And we'll jump back to this in just a moment. We can pick up exactly where we left off. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Phoebe Bridgers has something in common with her fellow excellent songwriters. She can tackle something super sad and still work in some great jokes. She'll tell you about her new album, why she started writing songs, and the unexpected fallout after smashing her guitar on Saturday Night Live. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC, next at 7 o'clock on 91.7 KALW and online at kalw.org. The time now is 6:30.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined tonight with co-host Dean Johnson, where tonight we're discussing animal law with animal law attorney Corey Page and Pets in Need Executive Interim Executive Director Valerie McCarthy. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local area and you want to call us toll-free, that number is 866-798-8255. Won't cost you a dime. 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking about the laws, responsibilities, rights involving animals. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation, which, where we left off, was talking about what may well be an evolution towards treating animals as though they have rights, which seems to be more complicated. We were talking about animals that are foodstuff versus animals that are pets. And we haven't even touched the gray area where certain types of animals might be either or.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, I see this as a classic piece of legal evolution. I mean, to make what might be a bad analogy, if you remember Justice Scalia's decision on the Second Amendment declaring, yes, there is a right to own a gun. But at the end, he said, well, yeah, there is a right, but exactly how broad this right is remains to be seen. And that'll evolve over years and years, which apparently it's doing. I see the same thing for animal rights. I see animal rights as a great tool and the obvious connections to things like climate change. I mean, could you bring a suit on behalf of an endangered species to limit climate change? Or, you know, the meat industry, the way they handle animals. In California, we have something called the Humane Slaughter Act. If there was ever an oxymoron, that's it. I could certainly see this as a legal tool for people like Corey who want to further the welfare of animals. So what do you guys think?
Well, I think you're right that you're kind of foreshadowing paths that a lot of attorneys are working on. I wanted to mention one more thing about this. As Valerie was talking about, before we went to station break, she mentioned, you know, recognizing rights and the evolution of rights, that it's going to start at home with our most beloved companions, because that's the low-hanging fruit. And what I was trying to say, and it plays out in this domestic animal, is that we have this split personality with animals that we become our own impediments to granting rights. And how this plays out, as you can see, for example, is we do a number of vet malpractice cases out of my office. And when you take your animal to the vet will do all the services you request, all the life-saving measures they suggest, and they will treat your animal with the respect and love that you treat your animal. However, if they make a mistake, and you bring a lawsuit and say, look, that was malpractice, you completely blew it, they will say your animal's fair market value is blank, so that's the level of your damages. Now, this is, think about this, because this is a party to your bond. This is a party that serves your family member really closely, and they're also creating that split within the concept of animals really have an inherent, beautiful, nurturing, wonderful, caring, impossible to put a value on component in our lives. But yet, if they mess up and they kill your animal and you sue them, that animal is $300 to replace, and that's the max I'm going to pay you. And they stand firm.
Let me turn it over to Lali from Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, good evening. My question is about some obligations, duties that companions of dogs should be encouraged about. Picking up after the dogs on trails, parks, sidewalks. I find that, you know, owning, having a dog in your life is wonderful, but it doesn't come with just feeding them, petting them, taking them to the vet. It also includes picking after their business, you know. How can we encourage this behavior?
Well, from a shelter standpoint, when we adopt out animals, we have a packet of not only how to take care of your animal, but some of the responsibilities involved with that. And we actually do list that, and we provide at low cost or free if they need it, dog bags, et cetera, on that side. Some of it is sort of public education on that side. I've also seen it as far on the far end and in New York City, where I lived before, is the city ordinances had dog poop pickup requirements, and they could actually be fined if they didn't follow the ordinance. So I'm not sure if we're there yet in that manner, but and Corey could speak more to what a more densely populated area like San Francisco might be dealing with it, how they might be dealing with it.
Yeah, San Francisco and other municipalities have laws that do require pickup. The bigger problem, and I agree with the caller, it's disgusting. It's unhealthy. It's really difficult as someone with a small child who wants to walk around and touch and explore to deal with this. And I completely sympathize. I think the problem animal control would say is you have to actually see the person doing it, or the dog doing, like the person walking away, or the dog making the poo and the person walking away, to cite them. And that's a really hard thing to do, because you basically have to have animal control sitting around like police officers at intersections waiting for a red light violation. So it would be a PSA, public service announcement type issue, where you have to encourage people to do the right thing as opposed to the law, because the law is already there in most municipalities. It's just getting people to understand that, like you said, caller, that the obligation that comes with caring for an animal and having that friend is to bring their waste back and put it somewhere where it's properly disposed of, and not leaving it out for other people to deal with.
One thought that occurred to me when Lali was asking the question: I live across the street from a very large park, and at several entrances to the park, the city has boxes, not for collection, but for dispensing the bags to put them in and make it easy. Maybe encouraging it by making it easier for people might have a more beneficial effect than trying to police them, which I think is an insurmountable task, unfortunately. Let me take the next caller, Mary from Albany. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello. I just wanted to hear more about what Corey started to say about Elon Musk's company that was trying to put chips in, I think he said, into the brains of chickens to try to control them, or see how to what extent they could control them.
Yeah, thanks for being interested. It's not actually chickens. It's macaw monkeys, rhesus macaw monkeys. And it's inside the skulls of the rhesus macaw monkeys. And you definitely can do easy Google research and see what they're doing. It's what Neuralink's whole purpose is. The idea is, if we can do this for monkeys, then we can do it for humans later on. Put chips, implant chips in our skull. And so if someone has suffered some injury, that these chips can do something to help them. So what they did was Neuralink, the company, paid UC Davis research unit to do research for them and in coordination with them. And so they both did the research together in UC Davis on the animals. So I represent groups and individuals who are wanting the records. They want to know, okay, what's happening there? How are the animals getting treated? Let's see the pictures of the animals and their conditions. Let's know how they're enriched, the animals' lives, while you're doing this. You know, we have something called the Animal Welfare Act, and Dean, not so jokingly, said, you know, oxymoronic statement of the Humane Slaughter Act. Animal Welfare Act is similar to that, because the Animal Welfare Act isn't about how much, how can we help animals? It's how much can you hurt animals before we stop you? And so places like UC Davis, they're subject to the Animal Welfare Act, but the limitations are minimal in terms of the research and what can be done. So exactly what we're doing, what the suit is it's trying to get the records, the photographs and the videos of what was happening to those animals while they're in the care at that facility.
And of course, the one thing that Corey failed to mention is that once Elon Musk puts the chips in the monkeys' skulls, they will be able to post on Twitter.
Not only that, but they can assemble Teslas much faster than the unionized employees who might be there at some point. But I digress.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, one of the things that Corey alluded to is the patchwork of laws from community to community. And I kind of wanted to jump ahead and ask about that as it relates to such regulations as animal cruelty or dangerous animals.
Yeah, so you're asking how the patchwork kind of intersects with animal cruelty and dangerous animal issues.
Exactly.
Yeah, so on a federal, I mean, this kind of bubbles down and down and down. There's a thing in the law called preemption, and I'm sure you're both aware of it. And for the callers, you know, you got federal laws, you got state laws. If the federal laws are on a topic, then the states can't legislate on the same topic. And then if the states have laws, and then localities have laws on the same topic, the localities get preempted. So there's questions about what states can do to protect animals. And a lot of the animal agriculture cases we've done, or the animal confinement cases within the agriculture sector, end up hitting against federal preemption issues, meaning the defendants from the meat industry and the agricultural industry will argue that the federal government already legislates in that area. Luckily, with things like local animal welfare stuff, that doesn't happen, because a lot of the state codes allow local legislation. Specifically, if we just tailor this right into vicious, dangerous dog statutes and ordinances, the California state code, state statute says that, and it's in the Food and Ag Code 31621, it says that municipalities, if they don't like the framework that the state laid out for what's a vicious dog, what's a dangerous dog, they can do their own, and they're not preempted, and that becomes the one. So what has happened is cities and counties throughout California have done their own, and the result is you have a patchwork, which is great in some ways and really bad in other ways. It works well for comparing like a very rural place to a very urban place. You wouldn't want to have the same requirements and limitations and labels of dogs for certain behavior, because some behavior is expected or allowed. But when you compare cities or counties that are right next to each other, and then one dog is labeled vicious and going to be put down, and in the other county that dog's behavior is not, it becomes problematic for the people who care for the animals to feel like the system's fair.
You know, Valerie, I assume you guys at Pets in Need get your share of aggressive animals, most usually dogs. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, we do. So we get a range of aggressive dogs, and because we're a municipal shelter, we're required to take the dogs on that side. So we have a behavior staff, and who are trained to work with these types of dogs. And we also have some outside consultants that we call on for particularly dangerous cases. There are cases where a dog might injure either an employee or another dog or a person or a dog in the community out on walks on that side. And as that happens, as it escalates, the ACOs, the animal control officers who watch over our shelter, might recommend the dog to go to a dangerous dog hearing. And so in that case, the dog would the case of the dog would go before the hearing and would be discussed. And there would be, in some cases, we've had the dog designated as a dangerous dog, and there's an opportunity for appeal. But when the dangerous dog designation is given to the animal, there's some severe restrictions that are placed on the animal. If the doctor for a dangerous dog animal in our municipality of Palo Alto is required to have a certain amount of insurance, is required to have a fenced yard, et cetera, it's pretty onerous in what it takes to take in a dangerous dog from the community.
Now, a dangerous dog hearing, is that a city function, a county function? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a city function for us. It's a city function, and it's done within the police department.
So a dangerous dog, the definition of a dangerous dog could vary depending on whether they were in the Redwood City shelter or the Palo Alto
exactly,
shelter.
Exactly. And that's part of the patchwork. And then the requirements of a dangerous dog also differs from one city to the next. And so we struggle with that as we cross not only cities, but counties at Pets in Need between Santa Clara County and San Mateo County.
Oh, I think we have more callers coming up, Jeff.
That we do. Let me turn it to Raymond from Millbrae. Raymond, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, good evening. Very interesting discussion. I don't know. I think I love animals more than humans, but...
Easy to do.
Yes, but I find some of these clinics here, at least in California, such I don't want to name names, but they really, all they care about is the funding and the money. And you talked about UC Davis. They're actually the only people who are honest with me about my dog who had cancer. And I went to various clinics here in the Bay Area, in particular in Redwood City. And my dog was there for 39 days and they told me, oh, she just had a fake pregnancy where in reality she had cancer. Had they told me earlier, she would be alive today. And I find so many, most vets that I know, at least from the Bay Area, like from Tufts when I used to be in Cambridge at Harvard, they were wonderful people. They loved animals and they'll be honest with you. But I find here in the Bay Area, many of the, a lot who are very dishonest.
Yeah.
How I find it is absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm the guy who donated the building in Burlingame, so on a condition that they don't put any animals to sleep unless they find till they exhaust their means, they cannot find a shelter for it or an adoption.
I think we're in a really difficult time right now in veterinary medicine, and we're seeing that here in locally in Palo Alto, in the Bay Area, and nationally as I'm on national calls. And it's the shortage of medical staff in the industry is under pressure it hasn't ever seen before, and part of it is because it's a really really hard industry, incredible amount of pressure. And so the burnout rate is pretty severe. And at the same time that you're having that, we've had an explosion of pets coming into the homes through COVID, and there's this surge of adoptions. And so that just creates an incredible pressure and backlog on veterinary medicine on that side. So I'm sorry you've had some difficult cases or a difficult situation on that side, but I just want to point out that it's just a really hard time, and it's a pressure-packed industry on that side.
And I'm curious, Valerie, do you vet the adopters when somebody comes in to adopt a pet at Pets in Need?
Yeah, so we do. We have an adoption application, but it's the way that we've moved with our adoptions is really to a conversation. And so what we're trying to understand, or we're trying to communicate to the adopter as much as we can about the animal, the needs, the medical needs, the behavior characteristics, what we've seen in the shelter of what they do well, what they don't do well. All of that's with a caveat, is that it's known research that an animal behaves very differently in the shelter than it will in a home. And so it's very important for us to point out the behavior in the shelter, but it's also in research shows, in most cases, many of these behavior issues go away when they're in the home in a less stressed environment on that side. And so we communicate as much as we can about the animal to the adopter. We discuss the adopter's situation and we help them understand what might be a good fit on that side. And it's conversation based. And ultimately we like the adopter to make the final choice because they know the most about their home situation.
You know, that does bring up a question. I mean, we've just gone through a pandemic. It's affected a lot of our experience with veterinarians locally. They've been under tremendous pressure, and most of the veterinarians that I have dealt with myself have been on and off about whether you're even allowed to enter with your pet or whether they come to the car and get them, and just how much interaction. It's really a horrible time for that. And try to match that up with the idea, as we've all heard, that adoptions are way up during the pandemic. Is that still going on, or have things started to tail off?
They have slowed down a little bit, but it's still a very healthy adoption rate. And I would just say that one thing I want to point out is that we've all in the shelter industry, we've all have expected this influx of returns. And just because of the explosion of adoptions that happened in COVID, as
John
people
Barry?
Go back to work, we thought that we would have this influx, and we've actually been preparing for that. But it's not nearly as much as many as we have modeled. And I think this is in part due to, once again, the power of the human-animal bond. So these animals have become a part of the family, and it's really hard to give them up. So yes, in extreme hardship cases, we're seeing some of these returns come back. But in most cases, the families are working to figure out and problem solve how to make the new family addition work. And I would say also that the growing popularity of the hybrid work model, which we didn't necessarily put into our model to start with, we're seeing that, you know, become more and more prevalent, which is also helping to keep the return rate down.
We do have another caller I'd like to try to get through before we run out of time. We have John Barry from San Francisco. Welcome to Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm a realtor and a property manager, and I have an odd question situation that has come up a couple of times for me, where I think people with dogs and cats are happier people than those who don't have the companionship. But I'm wondering what can be done to make sure that a property owner has the right to come down hard on their tenant who has a cat or dog, and the tenant is then abusing the cat or dog by pulling the toenails out of the cat or dog, or other kinds, clipping the, you know. Does a property owner have the right to tell the tenant, no, you can't do what you want to do to that pet because it's inhumane or whatever have you? That's my question.
From a lawyer's standpoint, I think that's an easy question. Call the cops. Animal abuse is a crime.
Do you agree with that, Corey? Do you think the owner's only remedy is to call the cops if things are going out of control?
I think there's that component. The one other component, I think, that I would, if I was consulted by John, I would probably say, let's see your rental agreements. Let's see what we can put in there. And let's see what kind of leverage we can get you. An average rental agreement, I agree. You have no business trying to enforce animal cruelty laws and make decisions. But depending on your contract, you might be able to wedge a finger in there just enough to make it unsavory.
We're running near the end of the hour, and I wanted to give each of you maybe 90 seconds or so for any closing thoughts or anything you wanted to relate. Corey, did you want to go first?
Sure. I think as people listening to the show and us on the show would undoubtedly agree that companion animals and agricultural animals and the animals we watch on TV are integral to us existing on this planet and feeling human. That is what we are. And that's why I think it was Raymond when he called in and he said, you know, I tend to like animals more than I do most people. And I think that's a universal feeling, because there's a honesty of love and connection that animals give us. And I think because of that, that unwavering honesty of an outpouring of love and connection without jealousy, without bitterness, and without, you know, trying to achieve some long game on us, that we owe them greater than we give them. We owe them a place in this world and in our lives that isn't just subservient to our needs. And even to the extent we feel like we need them for certain purposes, we need to do that in the most humane and most clear way. When I say clear, meaning the light shines through. Open records, open policy, open farm practices. We need everyone to know what we're doing to the animals that are around us and that we use for purposes that are not necessarily savory, but if society is allowing it, we need the light to shine through so we can all see what's going on, because a lot of times the bulk of humanity would agree that certain practices aren't okay. And they're willing to pay a couple more dollars for whatever it is to stop that practice. And I'm glad to be a part of it. And I really appreciate Jeff and Dean and the show for allowing me to participate.
Valerie, you want to take about a minute to 90 seconds?
Yeah, sure. I just want to follow up a little bit on a similar theme to what Corey said, is that I want to make two points here in the closing. One is that I fundamentally believe that you learn as much about a society in any way as you can by looking at the way that they treat their animals, and whether that be the way that they treat their companion animals, whether that be the liminal animals that are out on the sidewalk, or whether that be the way that you treat wild animals and the ecosystem that we live in on that side. And I think that as the law is evolving, it helps to guide us in that manner to be a better society and a better human culture. But we've got a ways to go on that. And I hope we continue to change on that side. And I just want to end by saying thank you to everyone out there that's brought an animal into their home and provided them a loving home and can enjoy that lasting human animal bond that is so important.
Dean, you want to take about 30 seconds?
Sure. Yeah, the Harvard philosopher Robert Paul Nozick once said that animal rights are part and parcel of human rights, and I agree. Our wild animals are part of the ecosystem that keeps us alive, and I think we have a fundamental right with respect to our beloved pets to see that they thrive and that they're happy and healthy. So I think that animal rights are going to become a powerful tool for lawyers to advance not only the cause of animals, but the cause of humans.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've been talking about animal laws. Our guests tonight have been the Pets in Need Interim Executive Director, Valerie McCarthy, and from Evans and Corey, we have Corey Page. And joining me tonight is co-host, NBC legal and political analyst, Dean Johnson. Our show tonight's been produced by Dean Johnson and yours truly. And my thanks again to our guests. And our thanks to all of you for joining us. For Dean Johnson and at the controls, D Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, be safe, and go Warriors.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. You're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area.